Thank you. I'll take about 5 minutes to address the issue of the disallowance of the claim and some time with respect to the confirmation of the Chapter 11 plan. With respect to the disallowance of the claim, we assert that the court, the bankruptcy court, committed error in not applying these factors in a way that we believe the case law would have required that they be applied. With respect to the four factors of what we all know, I'm going to sort of start out of order. The factor regarding good faith, there really is no dispute here that my client was acting in good faith. And these are parties that are litigating, start in state court, wind up in bankruptcy court. And that's how you're going to get your claim in the bankruptcy court is filing the proof of claim. The fact that, yes, it was late, we acknowledge that, okay? But that is not tantamount to bad faith. That goes to the issue of the excusable neglect. And there was no finding by Judge Saltzman that there was anything done in bad faith. She just didn't think that bad faith would necessarily put us over the edge on the excusable neglect argument. The next factor is, of course, the length of the delay in this. Please understand the following. I was not brought into the case at the very beginning. I get brought into the case after it's been commenced. There apparently has been at least one, if not more, hearings in the matter. There was a scheduling conference, which is quite common in Chapter 11 conferences, and there was a scheduling order that went out. Now, I was never served with the scheduling order. So when it came out, I didn't receive anything. It is correct, as my colleague, Mr. Goodman, says, that the appellant received it and the state court referring counsel received it.
But wasn't that adequate service? Was there any requirement to serve you?
To serve me?
Yes.
Well, Your Honor, I would say no, and basically for a very simple reason, which was I wasn't even in the case yet.
Sure. So the fact that they didn't give you notice is really neither here nor there, correct?
Well, for me, it is, in the sense that I, you know, had I received this, we might not be here today.
But let me ask you a follow-up question. You find out you're 6 months late on a claim. You file the claim. Did you file any sort of motion to say, wow, I realize this is 6 months late, but can you please allow this claim for the following reasons, Judge?
No, I did not. Here's what happened.
Yeah, you left that to the debtor to deal with, correct? You didn't deal with it.
Correct.
Okay.
But that was, the debtor had filed the first disclosure statement and the proposed plan on May 5th of 2019. I then filed the claim May 29th of 2019, and the debtor filed the first amended disclosure statement and the first amended plan.
To my point, 24 days elapse between the time that you realize there's a problem here, because you go back and look and realize there was a claims bar date, right? And you're filing a claim and you don't do, you know, what people might expect you to do. You don't bring it to the court's attention and say, can we deal with this?
I did not understand, though, that we already were running into the plan and disclosure statement, and I said, I will deal with it. In that realm, they then filed a first amended disclosure statement and first amended plan of reorganization.
And what did that change?
In terms of, well, they're not picking up the claim. There's not going to be any allowance for us, and they're objecting. That follows up with the objection to my client's proof of claim. Right. So in terms of, that did not stop the proceedings. The proceedings kept going. It didn't cause any prejudice to them. They already had, they filed their first amended disclosure statement and plan after I had filed the claim.
I have to disagree with you there. I mean, because your claim basically at least doubled the total universe of unsecured claims. How can that not have an effect on the plan confirmation process?
Well, there was still time to go back and recalculate the numbers, understand that the claim is on file by the time they go back and do the first amended disclosures and plan of reorganization. So there,
but in the way it's supposed to be done anyway, there, a lot of work has been done before a disclosure statement plan is even filed. And to have to be at the point where you're ready to go forward with plan confirmation, then all of a sudden this enormous unsecured claim pops up late, I just don't buy the argument that that doesn't affect anything.
Well, it might, but it's not to the point of where it's going to derail the entire proceedings, Your Honor. And so that is with respect to the length of the delay, sure, but with respect to the potential impact, we were still early on in terms of getting plans and disclosure statements out the door. You can amend a plan and disclosure statement 2 and 3 times before it gets approved and the plan is confirmed.
You know, I can always pay more, you know, I mean, it's theoretically possible to say, what's the number? Let's just pay more. But I mean, we're dealing with finite resources and your theory seems to be they could have paid whatever number I put in there. And this wasn't a liquidated claim in any event. So, you know, you're introducing both a big claim and the need to do an estimation process or something that's going to be very complicated because it's a complicated piece of litigation that's going to have to be litigated. So it's,
right.
It's huge.
Which is why they filed the Chapter 11 case. Recall that State Court Counsel filed the complaint June 5th of 2018, sorry, 2019, and they're in bankruptcy by July 20th of 2019. They weren't interested in litigating this in state court. They were interested in litigating this.
Right, but I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with whether your client's obligated to file a timely claim, right? I mean, even if people whose claims are known get notice and are told, file a claim, and they still have to file a claim even if their claims are known, correct?
That is correct, but I was responding to Judge Taylor's inquiry with respect to the large amount and the complicated piece of litigation, but it wasn't new. They knew going in. It is the filing of a lawsuit.
Also, you hadn't filed a claim for months, right? And aren't they entitled to rely on that and plan accordingly?
I said they also
knew you hadn't filed a claim for months, and aren't they entitled to rely on that and plan accordingly, which is exactly what they did.
Well, understand, the claim was not filed in the Chapter 11 case.
Understood.
But it was a claim in
understood.
In the individual Chapter 7 case. This would not come as a surprise to them by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay.
Go ahead, Judge.
Can I move you forward to another topic? Your proposal is that your client take payment on a subordinated basis, and that would extend the plan from 2.5 years to 5 years. And I guess my first point is, isn't this a 5-year plan to begin with? Where does the 2.5 years come from?
The 2.5 years, Your Honor, comes in. It's a payout to the unsecured, general unsecured creditors.
But the plan says that's going to take 5 years, doesn't it?
No.
Or am I just missing something?
No, I believe it says we have this at 2.5. But we're asking for a subordination to extend it out that way.
Let's pass it. The plan says what it says. Maybe I'm misstating it. We could figure that out. But wouldn't it take a lot longer than 2.5 years to pay your client $600,000 claim at the roughly $3,000 a month rate specified in the plan?
Remember that is that figure that we have there is an estimated amount, and so that figure could be much less than the $600,000. In fact, when we look at what they listed the company, my client, for in the individual Chapter 7 case, it was at $2 million. So $600,000 amount was certainly much less than the $2 million that the debtor has.
But that's not my point. My point is that at $3,000 a month, which is the monthly plan payment to unsecured creditors, it takes a lot longer than 2.5 years to pay the $600,000 amount that your client demanded, right?
It would be
just arithmetic.
Yes, but I'm estimating, if you will, the claim. I'm not sure that $600,000 would be what would eventually come to us.
It could be more. It could be $2 million, right?
It could be, but then again, it would be subordinated.
Okay, so let's talk about that. What's the legal basis for subordinating a late claim in a Chapter 11 case?
Well, in this particular case, the approach I took was I did not want to attempt to leap ahead of other unsecured creditors or any of that. I didn't want to prejudice them. And so I said, allow the claim to subordinate the claim.
Okay, my question is, I understand the practical notion there, but what's the legal basis for subordinating a claim in a Chapter 11 case because it's filed late?
I would just say this is a matter of equity, Your Honor. It is a late filed claim. I think that we could meet the pioneer factors, and even if you say we're not going to let you have it deemed timely filed and at the same level as the other unsecured claims, we'll let you in, but you got to stay at the back of the line.
Okay, well, we've taken you inside your 5 minutes, so
just get ready to say. So.
And in terms of the Chapter 11 plan itself, I was greatly concerned by some of the financial projections there. If you look in particular on the First Amendment Plan of Reorganization, Exhibit D, it is replete with expense line items that do not change throughout the course of more than a year and more than 2 years.
Okay, well, I have to ask you about that too, because you're now saying that the plan projections are unrealistic, but on the other hand, you just told us the plan should be extended for a period of years. How can both of those things be correct?
Well, what happens is this. When I raised the two issues, one was the allowance of the claim, the other one was the issue of the plan. I said, even if the claim is not allowed, if the claim wasn't allowed, then it follows. We wouldn't have anything in terms of the plan, but if the claim is allowed, our concerns would be this. So we see, for example, automobile expenses similarly, month after month after month, medical expenses, medical insurance expenses, workers' comp insurance expenses, maintenance expenses, everything is the same. In fact, the debtor tells us that they are looking to keep constant sales. They don't see increases in sales from July of 2019 to June of 2021. And so I'm thinking, how are you
So which is it? The plan payments are too low or too high? Which do you think it is?
Well, I think the plan payments are too low. The plan payments are too low. And I think in Chapter 11 practices, we all know, look, it's tough because you're projecting out. But by the same token, you have to have assumptions. Assumptions are not correct or incorrect. They're either reasonable or unreasonable. My pitch to you is, I think the assumptions here are unreasonable. It's unreasonable to assume that medical liability insurance premiums are not going to go up within a year. Same with automobile expense, maintenance, gasoline, all of these items, that they're going to be static. I just didn't think it was...
Let me just point out to you, you're down to 2 minutes. If you want to reserve some time, you can stop now.
Yeah, I will, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. All right, Mr. Goodman.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. The complaint was filed in the state court in June of 2018. I did file the bankruptcy in July of 2018. Notice the bar date was mailed out in September of 2018, setting November 15th as the bar date. I communicated directly with Mr. Ryan Piercy, who was the only one that I knew because he was the state lawyer. Client was served, I believe Mr. Fernandez didn't hear about March 14th, but he did state in the declaration in opposition to our objections to the claim that he was aware of our date. Filed it in May, and then as a question, nothing happened until the debtor filed its motion objecting to the claim in July. The court sustained based upon the factors of Pioneer. It wasn't until the end of that hearing, which Mr. Fernandez orally, it wasn't in any part of his written papers, said, well, if you're not going to allow it, would at least subordinate it. And the bank was gave this opinion. The order was entered, and then a motion for reconsideration was filed, in which the subordination issue was again raised without authority, just that it should be subordinated paid over time. I have a copy of the plan that sets forth general unsecured creditors in class 22, and specifically says the cash distribution to general unsecured creditors shall be paid in full over a period of 60 months, debtor paying the sum of $29.89.35 per month. Claims of insiders, which is Ian Jacoby, Jennifer Jacoby, have Mr. Jacoby about $360,000 and Ms. Jacoby about $50,000 will not be paid until after payments in full is made to non-insider general unsecured creditors. And that was ultimately, that didn't change. That was ultimately the plan that was confirmed by the court. There was no objection in that context by the appellant at confirmation. There were basically three objections. One was separate classification, which basically misread the plan. We attached an exhibit to the plan, which listed each creditor and how much they would get, et cetera. The unsecured creditors, the general unsecured creditors, were under class 22, and it listed the names, I think about 10 of them, and how much they were owed and how much they would get with the interest. And then we listed, because we had named all the employees, because of the nature of the lawsuit, we had 12 causes of action against debtor, against Mr. Jacoby, and against Mr. Eric Jacoby, who's not an office director or shareholder, but founded the company and then turned it over to Ian Jacoby back in 2009. We listed all the employees next to next to Mr. Williams. We indicated that he had a claim for $600,000 based on lawsuit and late file proof of claim, but he would receive zero because of the late file proof of claim. That was one of the objections. The other objection was good faith. We were paying everybody in full. It's 100% plan. And so the court overruled the objection to the good faith and feasibility. The cars, my client, because of the nature of the business and doing a lot of testing in HVAC situations, have a lot of employees that are on the road. They rent a lot of cars. And those are long-term leases of eyes. And so the amount of those payments don't change for a long time. They have, the plan was confirmed on the October 29th of 19. I believe they may, the debtor started making their first payment to unsecured creditors in October. They have continued, I believe, to do it.
Let me stop you for a second and ask you a question. What would be the practical impact on the bankruptcy case if we were to reverse either the plan confirmation order or the claim disallowance order? What would happen after that, do you think?
What would happen is the debtor would most likely have to seek to employ special litigation counsel as expertise in employment law, because every one of the 12 causes of action are based upon California statute, employment statutes. You would have to then figure out where to litigate or perhaps estimate the claim. I know bankruptcy judges tend not to like litigating, trying cases with dealing with state court issues. We might have to go back to the Ventura County Superior Court where this was filed, and watching the nature of circumstances, they are just getting back on their feet. In fact, I have a case where there was trial date, which has been vacated and turned into a trial setting conference.
But it's your view that you couldn't really propose a plan until you have the claim liquidated.
We listed as contingent, disputed, and liquidated. At no time did Mr. Piercy, who's a state court lawyer, or Mr. Fernandez, after he came in, seek relief from the automatic stay to go back and litigate in the Ventura County Superior Court. And this goes back to July of 2018, when there wouldn't have been an issue. I've attended, four or five, six status conferences in the state court, and I think there's another one set for.
Okay, so you're. I think we get the point that you'd be stuck for some indefinite and fairly long period of time. After that, let's suppose the claim gets liquidated at some large amount. Let's just say $600,000. Then what?
Then we're going to have to go back with the numbers and most likely, file. Seek to modify the plan and changing the numbers with regard to how much creditors, including Mr. Williams, got paid, unless I guess we were going to subordinate him until after the insiders get paid. But that's arguably, 10 years from now. You have creditors who voted. You have a secured creditor in Ventura County Credit Union, who, by the way, dismissed the non-dischargeability case against my client almost 2 years ago. And so there's only the one by Mr. Williams and Mr. Jacoby's case. But we would have to modify it and figure out how much we could pay creditors, whether we need to see if we can get money back or stop paying them for a while.
Are you saying that it would be impossible to go forward to confirm a plan if this claim got liquidated in some large amount, or is it possible? I'm not saying.
I guess I would use the word possible, improbable. Depending on the number. I mean, if we were to be successful, we then have substantially more administrative fees that we have to deal with, and we'd have to look at what the total number was. Without telling tales out of school, we tried to mediate it and we're so far apart on the jury and we didn't last that long. It would be difficult to modify the plan. Certainly, with paying everyone 100 cents on the dollar, that number would certainly have to change.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make sure that I am liquidated. The other thing is, with regard to the objections to the plan, while there were three objections at the time of confirmation on appeal, there is only really one argument, and that's separate classification, which wasn't raised in the trial court. Mr. Williams' claim was disallowed. But in appellant's brief, page 13, they talk about, and it's a very short argument, that there wasn't a separate classification for his claim, rather than the mistake that was made, for the bankruptcy court. So that to me is a new argument. That was made, and again, it seemed to me as I read these papers several times that really what appellant is seeking to do or hoping to do is get some sort of claim and have that subordinated and allowed so that Williams can get some sort of payment out of the debt and out of Chapter 11, perhaps because he wasn't involved in the failure to file a timely proof of claim or the failure to take any affirmative steps after filing it in May to seek to deem it timely or call me and seek if we'd stipulate and instead waiting for the debtor to file its motion objecting to the claim in July, which was sustained and then filed the motion consideration, which rehashed Pioneer factors, and then for the first time, other than the oral request, the almost rejecting the claim, that could be subordinating the other claims. Fortunately, the facts that would be on the relied on 2.5 years are just incorrect. Unless the court has any questions.
Any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right, Mr. Fernandez, let's see how much time you have. You have 1 minute and 53 seconds to do rebuttal.
Thank you again. With respect to the issue of if you send this back, what happens? Plan payments continue going. We've never asked that those be stopped. We've never asked that anything be taken back. That's number one. Number two is, I don't think we'd be going back to Ventura County Superior Court. The reason being that we have the 523A6 against Mr. Jacoby in the bankruptcy court before Judge Tai. And so we might just focus that way there. However, the issue of the administrative expenses, remember that they went ahead and they filed the Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They were going to expend the money, whether it was in the Ventura County Superior Court or in the bankruptcy court. That's not something new that's coming on, okay? And in terms of the pioneer factors, I again would reiterate that, yes, it was a calendar mistake. I did put case law in there from the Ninth Circuit, the Pinkay versus Andrews case regarding the late filed notice of appeal. And so prejudice to the debtor, there's always a risk of that, but I think that our approach to it has been, let's litigate this thing, don't stop payments to the other unsecured creditors, continue plan performance, and let's see where it comes. Do you have any questions? I'm happy to take them.
I have two things I just want to say. First of all, Mr. Fernandez, I do appreciate the way that you've taken a responsibility for what happened here. That's the right thing to do, and I do appreciate that. And Mr. Goodman, I also can't help but notice that it would be probably in Mr. Jacoby's personal interest to have this claim allowed in the corporate case because of the potential non-dischargeability of that debt. And I appreciate that you and he have fulfilled your fiduciary duty in putting the interests of the company ahead of his personal interests. So that's just my statement. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. Can I respond briefly to that? Mr. Jacoby's in a Chapter 7 that has been discharged. He's received his discharge.
But there's the pending action.
The pending non-dischargeability action is under 523A6.
Right.
So they've got to prove both malicious and willful actions.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to say you're doing the right thing
people would have said, take your claim against the company, let the company pay as much, get the monkey off my back, and he hasn't.
Right.
I apologize and thank you.
Quite all right.
Thank you.
Quite all right. Thank you.
Thank you for your good argument. This matter will be deemed submitted and we will be in recess. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This session of the United States Bankruptcy Appellate Panel of the Ninth Circuit is now adjourned.